Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Wilmington's 7th Street Peninsula is home to a number of businesses and seen as a potential site for significant development. But persistent flooding there and the specter of sea level rise cloud its future.
We don't want to send anybody out of here because we've made it. Our study says that you shouldn't be here. But we do at some point want to help them decide if they're going to go or they're going to stay.
We take a closer look at what planners and businesses say about the 7th Street Peninsula. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about a new charter school in the works in Sussex County. Plus, our arts playlist highlights a downstate concert celebrating Women's History Month. And Enlighten Me brings us winners of the UD Center for Political Communications Voices Matter audio essay contest. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Regional planners hope to solve flooding problems on Wilmington's 7th Street Peninsula, where sea level rise could eventually make the flooding even worse. As Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt reports, business owners there don't want to move, and some want to see more development.
Most land on the 7th Street Peninsula is surrounded by water, the Christina River on one side and the Brandywine River on the other. With vacant commercial land, riverfront views, and two small parks, some see it as a location like no other. Marion Young is president of Brightfields, a brownfield remediation company located on the peninsula.
We love where we are because we're in the city and yet we're in the country.
But Young says about once a year, her employees can't get to work because the one road onto the peninsula is flooded out.
It's deep all the way to Industrial Street, which is our street, and that whole little area in the, you know, where the streets come together, and you'll have to take a boat. Now you're in a canoe, imagine yourself, and then as you go up Industrial Street about maybe a fourth of the way, then you'll hit dry land again.
If she can predict the flood a day in advance, she tells her employees to take work home with them. But she says the flooding impacts her company's productivity.
I thought of buying a duck, like there's those amphibious vehicles that they take people on tours in.
Young has also considered a covered boat or a truck with a snorkel on it. She has not considered moving her business. She says the building is customized for them.
We have garden beds here that we grow our food in, and we have composting. We don't have any parking to pay.
And Young is not concerned about sea level rise making matters worse. She notes her property does not flood, largely because her company chose to raise the ground up several feet above the elevation of the Wilmington riverfront along the Christina River. But some properties might not be so lucky. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a high sea level rise scenario could leave about a quarter of the peninsula underwater by 2040 and roughly half of it underwater by 2060. Dave Gula is a planner at the Wilmington Area Planning Council, or WILMAPCO. As part of the 7th Street Peninsula Master Plan, he's looking into how businesses like Brightfields may cope with flooding in the future. He says some areas of the peninsula, like the edges and the thinnest part in the middle, may be hard to protect.
Even if we do our best 20 years from now, it might not be sustainable, because if sea levels are rising and we're getting more intense storms, there are areas that are just, sometimes they're better left to return to nature.
But he says determining which properties are sustainable involves talking to businesses.
We don't want to send anybody out of here because we've made it. Our study says that you shouldn't be here. But we do at some point want to help them decide if they're going to go or they're going to stay.
One option for flood mitigation is an armored shoreline, but Gula says it could be cost prohibitive. Another option could be a buffer of undeveloped land around the edges of the peninsula with a trail.
And if we connect it to existing trail networks, that could be a really great network for recreation and fitness for folks who live on the east side who don't have as much access.
Dealing with flooding is not the only goal of the study. Gula says it also seeks to improve general accessibility to the peninsula.
We've got a lot of cultural amenities, and we want to get people here and make it easier for them to come and visit so that it's not a daunting task. Oh, I'd love to go to the Calmar Nickel, but it's so hard to get there. I mean, that's a bad thing.
And several businesses on the peninsula would like to see more development.
I would say more artsy type industry, you know, along with the, you know, with like a restaurant element. It just feels right.
That's Scott Humphrey, who recently announced his company, Light Action Productions, is building a soundstage on the 7th Street Peninsula. Humphrey says the company will employ 50 or so people, plus contract workers.
There's going to be this energy out there that isn't there right now.
Humphrey says the peninsula offers his company a unique amount of space.
There's 20 acres of land we bought out there. We're only developing 9 of the 20. As time goes on, we can expand within that same area, which we wouldn't have had that opportunity anywhere else.
According to Young, the Light Action property was raised up when it was remediated before being sold. Humphrey says for him, raising the roads is also a must.
Other than natural disaster, we can't have a situation where our employees or our customers can't get to our facility, period. Like, we can't have even one day of that.
Kathy Parcells is the executive director of the Kalmar Nickel Foundation, which maintains a tall ship and education center near the Isthmus of the Peninsula. Parcells says the foundation hasn't had any flooding problems since the new building opened in 2015. The property was raised about 10 feet above the previous building, which had flooded.
When we were building this new building, we actually considered whether it would make sense to move somewhere else. And the fact is, we have a fantastic dock. We had enough space to really handle all of our needs. And the big bonus is that we are located, you know, sort of yards away from the original landing site of the Kalmar Nickel in 1638.
At a public input session for the master plan last month, self-described bike advocate Gail Robillard called for bike trails on the peninsula that connect to existing bike networks.
I want to make, walking and riding feasible for everybody.
Kalmar Nickel volunteer Charles Hayward recalled the restaurant up the creek that once operated at the end of the peninsula.
So more places like that right on the water are certainly a draw, as you've seen from the Wilmington Riverfront and all of that. So it'd be an extension of that.
Dave Gula from Wilmapco hopes to finish the study in April or May. But Brightfield's Marion Young says there are other factors she'll consider as she plans her business's future.
They're saying the sea level rise is going to be on a 30 to 50 year horizon. And then more recently, it's it's happening faster than we thought. But that's still a really long time. Typically a commercial building is a 30 year life. And so we'll eventually grow out of this, or it'll be, needing to be rehabbed, and we'll move for that reason probably before we move for water.
Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. Next, we head from Wilmington to Sussex County to learn more about a charter school in the works that hopes to emphasize putting its students in the community as part of their learning. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Sussex County could see its second public charter school by 2021 if one educator has her way. Alana Burry is preparing to launch the Brian Stevenson School of Excellence, named after the lawyer and justice advocate Brian Stevenson, a Milton native. Burry is the school's founder and board chair. She says a capital campaign is slated for later this year to help get work on the school started. And Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele recently spoke with Burry about the Brian Stevenson School of Excellence and its service learning concept that would offer students opportunities to take what they learn in the classroom out into the community.
All right, so we've got this new public charter school that will eventually be opening in Sussex County. Tell me all about it. How did this idea come about? How did the name come about? Tell me everything you can about the Brian Stevenson School of Excellence.
Yeah, so essentially, this kind of concept started a little more than a year ago, and it really just kind of stemmed from my family, so I'm related to Brian Stevenson, and this actually happened after the passing of Brian's father. And the real question was just, what's our role here in Delaware? What's kind of the impact that we can have here in Delaware? And kind of from that initial conversation, outside of Brian, who's an attorney, a lot of our family are educators. And so kind of from that came this notion of a school. And then we coupled kind of that experience with my own experience at the time. I was in a national fellowship program called the Rural School Leadership Academy, where I had the opportunity to travel across the nation, actually started in New Mexico on a reservation and, you know, went from Idaho to Eastern North Carolina and got to see schools in rural communities, schools that were innovating in different ways. And I think what was clear from those experiences in seeing all of these different schools is that the challenges of rural communities are not that dissimilar from the challenges of urban communities, but there tends to be a lot more research and focus on urban schools than in rural schools. And so our kids are dealing with the same challenges of schools that have high numbers of low-income students, schools that have high numbers of students with special needs, et cetera. And so these are the, kind of the same challenges across the board. I think the other piece is when we think about the long-term kind of framing of it, which is what tends to happen in rural communities is that kind of there's kind of this mass exodus, so to speak, after senior year. It's this notion of everyone wanting to get out. And me being, again, a native Delawarean and growing up in the community, I saw this happen with all of my friends and with me for a while, too. I left and then made the intention to come back to Delaware. And that trend seems to be true across rural communities altogether. And so the big question here was, how do we impact that? How can we actually create a school that has students wanting to stay in their community and wanting to innovate in their community and wanting to add all the value that they have back into their own communities? And one of the things that Brian Stevenson talks about pretty frequently is this notion of proximity, that it was through proximity, through his experiences in the prisons. He could have been an attorney and practiced law for a very long time, but once he started going into prisons, it was that proximity to their experiences, to what actually happens, that was a kind of a life-changing experience for him. And so we thought, how do we get those kinds of transformational proximate experiences into a school experience, into a high school experience? And so from that, kind of that notion of proximity and the power of proximity, we came up with the Brian Stevenson School of Excellence, which we aim to be a high school. So we want to start 9th and 10th grade, and then we'll grow until we have a graduating class of 12th graders from there. But we want to be focused on service learning, because we think that by putting kids in the community that is, and we contextualize those experiences through their curriculum, through what they're doing in the classroom, but actually having kids get proximate with what's happening in their own communities, that is where we'll actually see some of that transformation happen for kids, and that they won't just want to leave, that they'll want to stay and really create change here in their own community. And that's the ultimate goal of this concept and of this school, is that we know that our community has all of the innovators and the great minds already in it. And we see, you know, the school as being kind of just the train or the engine that we can help them see their own power in themselves, and that they'll want to stay here and do the great work that they could do anywhere else, but do it right here in their home community of Sussex County.
All right. So, Alana, just clarify for me. You keep referring to, you know, kids leaving schools and going elsewhere. When students graduate from schools, yes, I would say most times they do go off to college in other parts of the country, or they move to take a job. So is what you're saying is this school teaching students to graduate and stay in the area?
That is absolutely correct. I think what the difference is, and what tends to be true in rural communities, is that they don't come back because there are more job opportunities in big cities, right? There higher paying salaries, et cetera, in big cities. And so what tends to happen when that happens over time on a repetitive basis is that the community itself begins to kind of lose out on that innovation and thinking that bringing those young minds back would bring to a community. And so we want our kids to go off to colleges and go off to great schools, right? And across the country, but ultimately we hope that through the service learning experience that we've planted, you know, a small seed for them to, when they begin to think about their career and their long-term career planning and about the impact that they might have on the world, that they would say, I can have that same impact back in Sussex County, Delaware, more often than saying, I want to go to a New York City or DC or Philadelphia.
Okay, but if there are no high paying jobs in Sussex County, which really there aren't, and that's the reason many people move away, how does the school, just because you went to the Bryan Stevenson School of Excellence, how does the school make higher paying jobs in a county where there is none?
Yeah, so I think it's about creating a longer-term kind of pipeline and ecosystem. So one of the other challenges with kind of recent graduates is around most folks get jobs through building their networks, right? And so by having kids start to build those firm networks at the high school level, so we're talking about real-world hands-on experience, kids going out into community centers and to doctor's office doing service learning. And so not only is that, again, giving them those proximate experiences, but it's also giving them that real world experience and where they're building connections and hopefully will be long term. And so I think there are two pieces to the puzzle. So one, we have to have more people willing to innovate in the area in order to create more jobs. That's how jobs are created. And so I think a piece of this theory is around, we first need to get the innovators back to create the jobs. And then the second piece is also that for most people right out of college, kind of like your baseline job, that happens through kind of what experiences you had, what internships did you have, what connections did you make. And we also believe that through this kind of service learning model that will create stronger networks for kids so that when they are on the job hunt, they can think back to this experience where they've already built a connection with a local executive director or someone like that, so they could easier, it will be easier for them to find good jobs here as well.
What areas are you looking in to get this school up and running? What areas of Sussex County?
So we are currently looking at multiple sites, but our intention is for it to be as centralized as possible. So kind of Georgetown, Milton area, because we want to be able to be accessible to all kids across the county. And so having a centralized location would allow us to do that.
This is going to take some fundraising. So when has that already started, or when will it start? And walk me through that process.
Yeah, so any charter schools will become nonprofits. And so nonprofits, we would fundraise like any other nonprofit does in the area. And so, yes, we've definitely begun some of that work and starting to have some of those conversations with local funders, but it's going to be a long-term project. And we have an interest in, you know, kind of funders of all, at every lens of the scale. And we think it's really important to have kind of community member input and into this as well. And so we've had a lot of small kind of size donations in like a traditional kind of crowdfunding format. And then we're also in conversations with the larger scale funders. But we, you know, we'll be launching a whole capital campaign later in the year, which would support the actual building and funding the building itself for the school.
Anything else you want people to know about Bryan Stevenson School of Excellence?
Yeah, I think just overwhelmingly we're really excited to be kind of working on this project together. All of the members of our board are, you know, in Delaware and really devoted to Delaware and Sussex County. And we just hope to really just provide another option for kids here in Sussex that might work for them. It's true to believe that, you know, there isn't a one-size-fits-all for kids, and that's true for learning as well. And we hope to be a school that will work for some kids in the way that they need learning and understanding. And so that's why we're here, and that's why we're doing the work.
Thanks to Alana Berry, founder of the Bryan Stevenson School of Excellence, and R. Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. You can get more information about the school at BASSEinc.org. And stay with us. Kelly Steele will be back with us in our next segment, bringing us this week's Arts Playlist and a look at a downstate choral group's upcoming concert celebrating Women's History Month. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. March is Women's History Month, and to mark the occasion, the Cantabile Women's Chorus performs a Women's History Month concert called Finding Our Voice in Lewis on March 24th. The Cantabile Women's Chorus is a program at the Music School of Delaware's Milford branch, and has been in existence for only 2 years. And this is the group's first standalone concert. Joanne Ward is Cantabile's director, and in this week's Arts Playlist, she chats with our Kelly Steele about the group and this concert. They're also joined by the music school's Milford branch director, Amos Fayette, who will be a guest artist in this concert, playing violin.
What's this concert all about?
Well, Cantabile, I have to give you a little background, but our Cantabile has been in existence for just shy of 2 years, but this is a chorus that is designed for women who really want to hone their singing skills and sing beautiful music in a warm and welcoming environment. We decided that for our very first standalone concert, we wanted to do something that was meaningful. It's lovely to sing beautiful music and have a nice audience, but we really wanted our concert to do a little more than that. So we looked around, and I'm relatively new to the area, but someone told us about People's Place, which does wonderful work for young girls who have been removed from their homes by the courts, for sheltering battered women. And we thought, well, March is Women's History Month. What a wonderful time to see if we couldn't put a concert together that would not only give us a chance to hone our skills and get out in front of the public, but also do something that will benefit somebody else. So this concert on March 24th, as you mentioned, is actually free to the public, but we will take a free will offering, and all proceeds will go to support the good work that People's Place does.
Now, give me some background about the Cantabile Women's Chorus itself. What's the makeup? How many members? Where do the members come from?
We are from primarily Sussex County oriented. I have another women's choir in Wilmington that is much older, has been around for 15 years. But Cantabile came into existence because once my husband and I moved here and I became involved in the artistic community, it became very apparent that there are wonderful community choirs in Sussex County, Southern Delaware Chorale, Camp Rehoboth, all kinds of things, but there's nothing that really speaks to the great literature that is written for women voices, for the ability of women to come together with a common cause. And that's kind of where Cantabile came from. It was actually people who approached me, would you be willing to start a women's chorus down here? So last year we had about 26 members. This year we had somewhere in between 22 and 24, depending on, you know, who's traveling and whatnot. We run an age from 18 to mid-70s and everything in between. You have to have a little background in choral singing, but you don't have to be classically trained. We do a wide genre of music, but we really try to honor women's composers, music about women, by women, for women. And yeah, we have fun, but we work very hard.
Who are past women's composers that you've honored?
Oh my goodness. Abby Bettinas, I don't know if you're aware, but the Alfred Burt carols that were around when I was a little girl, they were written by a family, a
her great-grandfather actually sent them out as Christmas cards every year. And she is a contemporary composer. I just met her at a convention 2 days ago, as a matter of fact, who writes primarily for women's voices. Andrea Ramsey, an up-and-coming woman's composer this year, will actually do two pieces by Andrea Ramsey, one called The Roof, one called The Rising, and they speak about rising out of pain and overcoming adversity and that sort of thing. Gwyneth Walker is a wonderful woman's composer who lives in Maine. She's a little teeny tiny little old lady, but writes the most amazing music. We're going to do a piece by Gwyneth Walker called From Dusk to Dawn, which is actually based on the text of a woman named Lema Djibouy, who was the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize winner, and she led Liberian women in peaceful protest of the civil war that was going on in her country, and it's based on her text. Oh my goodness, all kinds of people. Susan Borwick, who wrote a fantastic piece that we're doing called And Ain't I a Woman, based on the text of Sojourner Truth, who was a woman's rights and a civil rights advocate at the mid-19th century, and she spoke, believe it or not, to a women's rights movement in Ohio in the 1800s. Yes, it actually goes back that far. So yeah, lots of wonderful women writing great music today.
I can hear the excitement in your voice. How important is this event for Women's History Month?
I think it's extremely important. I think it's important that we, especially in this day and age, and what we are experiencing, you can see it in the news. You can hear it in the voices of women around the country. But I think it's extremely important that we make our voices known in a peaceful and social justice kind of atmosphere. You know, when I was young, when I was growing up and singing in the mid 60s, the music written for women was really just reworked music that was written for SATB choirs, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, so male, female. And there was very little music that was written solely for women's voices. Mendelssohn did a little bit. You could find some with Bach, but not anything that was solely for us. And today, in the last 30 years, that has completely changed. I won't live long enough to do all the music that I would like to do.
Well, it sounds very exciting. Now, I know the branch director, the Milford branch director of the music school, Amos Fayette, will perform in this concert.
Yes. Amos is a very, very accomplished violinist, so he will be accompanying us on two pieces. We have a wonderful bass player, George Freeman, who is going to accompany us on this bluesy piece that I talked about, And Ain't I a Woman. And we are so looking forward to doing this. It's really, really going to be a great concert.
Amos, this concert is extremely important, right?
It's important not just because we're celebrating women composers, which is something that the classical community is doing much more of these days. It's also important just because these are people that we are seeking to draw awareness to people who we may not otherwise, as a society, pay that much attention to, and for no good reason other than sort of out of sight, out of mind. Many of the girls who are recipients of services from People's Place will actually be in attendance of this performance. They will be there as greeters and ushers. We wish for them to be front and center for this event.
That's great. Give me some background for people who are not familiar with the music school. Give me some background.
All right. So the Music School of Delaware we are a rather unique institution. We are the only statewide and nationally accredited community music school in the entire country. We offer classes, ensembles, and private lessons for children as young as 4 months of age, all the way through octogenarians. Basically, we believe in more music for more people in more places.
Anything else that I am leaving out, not asking you about this concert that you want people to know about or about the music school?
The Music School of Delaware is, again, we are very proud to support, to act in support and in partnership with People's Place. The Cantabile Women's Chorus is a is an absolutely fantastic ensemble made up of 20 or so of the most wonderful singers you will ever hear. And we certainly hope to see you at this performance on March the 24th.
All right, so Joanne, tell us how we can get tickets and give everybody again the location of the concert and the date of the concert.
Okay, it is March 24th, Sunday, March 24th. The concert is at 4 p.m. It's at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Route 9 in Lewis. There are no tickets. It is totally free to the public, but we will take a free will offering, and all of those proceeds will go to the wonderful work that the women at People's Place do for, as I said, women at risk, battered women, young girls who suffer terrible home situations. So we're very happy to be able to do this.
And I don't think we've mentioned the very special guest that you're going to have.
Oh, yes. We are so excited that Bethany Hall Long will be opening the concert for us. So, it's really a great tribute to women and the good work that we do.
Thanks to Cantabile Women's Chorus Director Joanne Ward and Music School of Delaware Milford Branch Director Amos Fayette for joining our Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist. And we close out this week's edition of The Green Next with a special Enlighten Mid, highlighting the winners of the University of Delaware Center for Political Communications Voices Matter Audio Essay Contest. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We finish up this week's show with a special Enlighten Me segment. Last fall, the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication held its second annual audio essay contest, Voices Matter. It was held in conjunction with the CPC's National Agenda Series, Midterm Matters, which included the 2018 Delaware debates Delaware Public Media helped produce last October. The contest offered UD students campus-wide the opportunity to join the conversation by submitting audio essays about the First Amendment, considering the questions, do you feel free to express your opinion? Have you been affected by hate speech? Have you ever experienced or witnessed censorship? What does the First Amendment mean to you? How have you made your voice matter? Dozens of students participated by producing a wide range of personal and emotional audio essays. Earlier this week, 10 finalists were honored at UD, and the first, second, and third place award winners were announced. Delaware Public Media was proud to partner on this contest and help judge the entries. And in this week's Enlighten Me, we're proud to give you a chance to hear the top three essays, starting with the third place award winner, The Word, from Jaimeer Stillis Stanford, a junior majoring in mass communication and psychology. He remembers a high school experience when he used his voice to combat ignorance among his non-black peers. A note here, the word the title of this piece references is the N-word, and Jaimeer uses it throughout the essay. Delaware Public Media has altered the original audio to bleep it out.
When I was in grade school, I remember chilling with my friends, having rap battles at lunch, with my hair slicked back in little Bow Wow cornrows. Coming from that, to becoming a chocolate chip surrounded by a sea of whipped cream in high school, let's just say the culture shock was overwhelming. I went from being able to relate with my bros on a deeper level to having superficial conversations about class, work, and teachers. I didn't realize the ignorance that some of my peers possessed when it came to situations regarding race. In my classes, I had to make my voice matter. As the only black person in many of my classes, I found myself becoming the spokesman for all black people. 2016. It was my final year of high school, and my classmates and I were almost at the finish line. I was so ready to get out of there and begin my life in college. After the last chemistry exam of the marking period, my teacher threw an end-of-the-year party for all of us. We had chips, drinks, and cupcakes. All we needed now was the music, and we decided that Broccoli by Dram was the way to go. I'm hitting the Dougie and Nene with my friends and laughing while rapping the lyrics. Hello mama, would you like to be my sunshine? But what I did not realize was that my non-black counterparts thought it would be alright to say nigga. Yes, nigga. At this moment, I knew I had to say something. I had to make my voice matter, not only for myself, but for my community. I walked up to the front of the class and proceeded to turn off the music. I was known for having a bold personality and telling someone off when I needed to. But I simply told them that using that word was harmful and that they should never say it again. My classmates looked at me in utter confusion and asked me why. Why? It was at this moment when I discovered that they genuinely did not understand. I was perplexed as to why they did not know, but regardless, I stopped and tried to put myself in their shoes. People who have grown up around the same people all their lives just don't know any better. They were oblivious. I explain why using this is disrespectful due to the historical context the word carries. Did your ancestors have to pick cotton to farm against their will? Nope. Were your ancestors beaten and whipped when they were defiant? Nope. Were your ancestors lynched, raped, and taken away from their families? No. Nigga, a phrase once used as a tool of oppression towards African Americans, has now turned into a liberated, highly contextual term for African Americans only. We have reclaimed using it as a word of endearment, while the non-black students in my class said it just because it was a song lyric. As I explained this, my classmates began to understand that they should not use the word. Instead of being aggressive and offended, I took the time to educate my peers and share a little piece of my life with them. My voice mattered. This moment sparked continued conversation throughout the rest of the week. I created a space where individuals felt free to talk about it and share their beliefs. If the conversations aren't started, then people will remain clueless and ignorant.
That was UD Junior Jaimeer Stillis Stanford and his audio essay, The Word. Again, Delaware Public Media altered the original audio to bleep out the use of the N-word. The unaltered version of this essay is available online at delawarepublic.org and cpc.udel.edu. Next up is the second place award winner, Shut Up and Listen, from Eric Hastings, who is working on his master's in public administration. He examines the lessons learned when people shut up and listen, why it's important to do so, and why it is dangerous not to listen.
When I was a kid, I'd often turn my family's living room into a courtroom, whereby I'd put my parents on trial for what I believed to be disproportionate punishments. One case got so heated that I told my mother to just shut up and listen. Sorry, Mom. Sometimes I'd get the, I'm the parent, that's final verdict, but she afforded me the opportunity for rebuttal. I was allotted a space to develop my voice without feeling judged or censored. This built confidence and translated into future experiences. I became a co-host of a radio show, a contributor to news outlets, a sports writer, and a public speaker. I've enjoyed free speech in settings that honored what I had to say. Eventually, I learned that's not the case for everyone. I returned to my hometown and took a job as a director of a program that serves at-risk teenagers, many of whom were minorities. I was excited, another place I could use my voice. When I started, I lectured them too much. It's what I was used to, talking. Luckily, I had a transformative moment when a young man challenged me to just shut up and listen. Right then, I saw a piece of myself, and I took the place of my mom in my living room. I listened, and the teens started to open up. It was slow at first. Some of them didn't make eye contact. They would mumble under their breath. I asked myself, what's the problem? Then it dawned on me. This was new to so many of them, for I had spoken freely in the world that felt like a living room to me, inclusive and comfortable. I never had to vent my words. Society just accepted them. I heard just about anything you can imagine from my teens. One told me about his broken relationship with his single mom, another about her struggles with being gay. But the most heartbreaking issue, some believed their voice did not or would not matter. I challenged them to speak up. After one of our more intense discussions, a young man pulled me aside and asked, "Why should I care if nobody's going to listen anyway?" That struck a nerve, he had given up already. Listening to him further, I learned why. A minority in this country needs to scream to be heard, whereas a white guy like me only ever needed to whisper. I have been offered a microphone at every turn in my life. It's time for me and others to hand it over. I've seen it too often, a white person grabbing the mic when there's a chance to let someone of color take center stage. If you'd got to know some of my teens, you'd be blown away. One of them was so creative that I have a tattoo on my leg he sketched for me to show how seriously I take his artistry. Another who called himself an average guy when we first met doesn't make excuses about coming from a single-parent home. He's at UD now, with me, and excelling. A girl struggling with her confidence became our program's leader and gave a speech at a major event. Big crowd, she brought them to tears. I hope my daughter's like her one day. If I had never shut up and listened, I would have missed out on learning from them. And that's what some of you are missing out on. What I see from some of my white peers is the polar opposite. They don't want to learn or to grow or to understand. They want to judge or to be right. They just want to win. In the past few months, I've logged on to social media pages to see a person of color sharing a Black Lives Matter post and a white person interjecting with, "Don't all lives matter?" I've seen white people distort the message behind the NFL protest, diverting attention on its true purpose related to police killings of unarmed black men. More, praising Trump's proposed border wall, knowing well Hispanic Facebook friends would see it. We are building walls every day with choices like that, instead of building living rooms. Why do you think it was so difficult for my teens to open up at first, especially to a white guy? Because they were used to being met with open mouths and closed ears. We've done more than our fair share of talking. Let's just shut up and listen.
That was Eric Hastings, a master's student at UD, with his audio essay, Shut Up and Listen. And finally, the first place winner, The Line, from UD sophomore Mia Carbone, who recalls a classroom discussion about the contentious Kavanaugh hearings and the trepidation of one young man, and considers how ultimately voices can indeed be drowned out.
Being a student studying politics and journalism has been nothing short of thrilling this year. Each day there is a new debacle to dissect or tweet to try, and it has resulted in fierce class discussions. One of the most notable events of this year and this administration so far was the road to the successful appointment of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. It was the week after the infamous hearing in my public policy class. Each class begins with a recap of current events, and I can't say that I've ever seen people so eager to get to a story. It unleashed an energy from our class that I had never seen before. Every woman in the class had something to say. Many of us were fired up, ready to defend Dr. Ford and her testimony to the earth's end. Each woman admitted that they knew there was no doubt Kavanaugh was going to be confirmed. Even after the riveting testimony by Dr. Ford, multiple allegations, a year of Me Too stories rocking every sector of life from brave survivors, he would still be a judge in the highest court in the land. In the midst of what began to sound like a broken record, a boy in class raised his hand. He told us that he felt scared. He felt scared and powerless in this modern Me Too era. I couldn't believe it. A heterosexual white man just told everyone he was scared to simply be himself. If you're a person of color, a woman, part of the LGBTQ+ community, or anyone who isn't a white hetero male, you might feel uneasy. I did. I blinked, and once again, every girl in class had her hand proudly raised high above her head. They rebutted with comments about what it's been like to be a woman leading up to this point and still. Even I raised my hand and asked him, "If you haven't done anything wrong, what is there to be scared of?" The discussion in this boy's comment specifically stuck with me, and so I later did some Googling and asking around to see if he was alone in his feelings. Turns out, he wasn't. It seems as though plenty of guys feel this way these days, but none of them feel like they can say so. Women's voices are louder than ever, with a strong and profound message, and for us women, this is amazing. We are showing our strength and refusal to continue our streak of silence after centuries of putting things on the back burner. But mixed up somewhere in our chance for equality, people became scared to share their side, to tell their story. I couldn't help but wonder if I was one of the people affecting if others felt safe voicing their opinions, even if they weren't opinions some of us necessarily wanted to hear. But this poses an important question. Where is the line between things we don't want to hear and things that shouldn't be said? This idea that people can't play devil's advocate or express their unfavored opinions has become something that our society is playing toward more and more. It's something I found myself guilty of practicing more than I care to admit. I find myself wondering if people feel like they can't say what's on their mind to me, or if I am part of the problem at hand. As admittedly silly as I thought this man's comment was, it made me think. The modern women's movement isn't the only topic where people feel silenced. In nearly every debate, political or not, those with the opinion of the minority may often be scared to speak up. But these ideas that are being withheld are ideas that need to be heard. They are what the First Amendment seeks to protect. Our right to freedom of speech means that every being in this country has the right to voice their thoughts, even if it's not something we want to hear.
That was UD sophomore Mia Carbone and her winning Voices Matter audio essay, The Line. These essays have been technically reproduced for broadcast by Delaware Public Media. Congratulations to the award winners, and thank you to them and all who participated in the Voices Matter contest for enlightening us. You can find a link to all 10 contest finalists at our website, DelawarePublic.org. And that's it for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, winners of the UD Voices Matter audio essay contest, Mia Carbone, Eric Hastings, and Jaimeer Stillis Stanford, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.